Hello, I'm Keith Pallon. Welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. An expert in Australian foreign aid says hundreds of millions of dollars promised to Papua New Guinea for hosting an asylum seeker detention center is unlikely to be threatened. Last week, PNG's Supreme Court declared the center on Manus Island unconstitutional, and the Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, announced that it would be closed. Officials from both countries are due to meet to work out what to do and what implications of the decisions are. The head of the Development Policy Center for the Australian National University, Stephen Howell, says most of the money promised to PNG for hosting the center is yet to be spent, and it's unclear what will happen from the court ruling. But he told Jamie Tuanua it's unlikely the aid package will be cancelled.
It was an agreement that came with benefit for PNG as well as costs. And the aid deal was, it was just over $400 million over 4 years. That's about $100 million a year. That was agreed back in 2013. But if you actually look at the aid to PNG, it's only gone up by about $15 million compared to what it was before the deal. So it shows that a chunk, most of that extra money hasn't been spent. And I think that reflects the fact that the money was tied to some new projects, the most prominent of which was the reconstruction of the hospital in Lae. Of course, that's a major undertaking, and you first of all got to design that new hospital, work out what to do with the old hospital, work out interim arrangements. And in that case, for example, the design has been completed, but the construction hasn't yet commenced. So I think, with this large amount of money being spent on new projects, it's not surprising that it's had a slow start and that most of that money remains unspent. Of course, it remains a question, well, what's going to happen to that money? Is PNG ever going to see these projects? Are they going to be seen through to completion? That's one of the unknowns. PNG will certainly be making the case that it has provided this processing centre for 3 years, that it was closed down by factors beyond their control, namely the Supreme Court decision. So they'll certainly be pressing for those funds to be spent and the projects to be completed. It remains to be seen what the position of the Australian government will be. But you've got to think, given the way Australia's reacted, given their determination that these asylum seekers and refugees should remain in PNG, they will need the cooperation of the PNG government in some form or other. And so you'd think it wouldn't really be in Australia's interest to start withdrawing that aid.
And I see now we've got Australian politicians, well, mainly the opposition, saying just offer Papua New Guinea some more money to change its laws or something. Is this easier said than done?
Much easier said than done. While PNG will press the case that existing aid commitments should be honoured, I don't think they'll be asking for more aid, and they certainly won't be offering in return a change in law. In fact, they did change the law, but the Supreme Court ruled that change in constitution was itself unconstitutional. So PNG's gone down that route. It's hard to think what else they could do to make this centre legal. That route is closed. And then in addition, it's not a popular deal. As I've said, it's now seen to have incurred these costs. And so apart from it not being really feasible, there doesn't seem to be the interest on the PNG side either.
An academic who's been banned from Fiji says the Great Council of Chiefs may no longer be relevant, but the way it was dissolved leaves a sense of unfinished business. The chiefly body was abolished by Frank Bainimarama's internal military regime 4 years ago, and last week Parliament voted a petition seeking to reinstate the Great Council of Chiefs. A former Fiji-based academic, Brigitte Lag, says there was time for indigenous Fijians were in the minority and concern for their interests might be threatened, but now they account for 60% of the population. He told Bridget Turnicliffe that Mr. Bainimarama dispensed of all institutional forces that were a threat to his power base.
And the second thing was that he utilized the ideology of the common person, that the Great Council of Chiefs was essentially an elitist body of indigenous Fijians, which did not have much resonance in the lives of ordinary Fijians. And through force, through decrees, he simply disbanded the Great Council of Chiefs, and that is where things are at the moment.
Was there some truth in Mr. Bainimarama's thinking that it was no longer relevant to the ordinary person? Was that a fair assessment?
Well, I think the important thing was this, that if the Great Council of Chiefs had lost its relevance, I think the important thing would have been for the indigenous Fijians as a whole to decide on what reforms might be necessary for the Great Council of Chiefs. Indeed, whether the Great Council of Chiefs itself was necessary in the changed circumstances. But there was no consultation, there was no dialogue, there was no discussion. Everything was done by decree. And I think that is the main problem with the way things were done and in fact are done now. It is a brute force of numbers, you know, that the government has in Parliament. And before the 2014 elections, it was ruled by a decree. So there was no discussion with the principal stakeholders in this situation, that is ordinary Fijians. That is the problem that lies at the heart of this issue.
In response to that petition being voted down, the opposition leader has sort of indicated that they don't need the government to help support this or fund this. There would be enough support in the community to set up the GCC without the government's blessing. Can you see that realistically happening? And if it did, would this organisation, what point would there be to it? Would it have any teeth?
The opposition does not need the government's approval to set up a body such as the Great Council of Chiefs. But the real question is, what function, what purpose will it serve? Under the present dispensation, it would have no administrative or constitutional authority of any kind. It might simply be a body that sits or meets once a year to consider issues relating to Fijian society, but whether that will have any influence on the government is something that I doubt very much, because this government is adamant that it must have its way virtually all the time. They have the numbers in Parliament and they will oppose the Great Council of Chiefs and indeed any other body that they see as a threat to their power.
There's a push for Pacific countries to have a stronger engagement with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. The IPCC is an international body for assessing the science related to climate change and was set up in 1988 by the World Meteorological Association and the United Nations Environment Programme. The IPCC's newly elected co-chair, Professor Jim Ski, was in New Zealand recently and he met Pacific representatives at Victoria University. Professor Ski told Mariah Tukapula-Taylor, Pacific countries were instrumental in pushing the ambition of limiting temperature rise to 1.5 degrees by the end of the century at the Paris Climate Change Conference.
One of the big challenges now is the IPCC now has to respond to the challenge that's been set. Well, how do you get to 1.5 degrees and what would be the impacts associated with it? And I think this is the stage. You know, historically, perhaps the Pacific Islands have had a lower participation in IPCC than we would like. And, you know, that's the big challenge to, you know, get people involved.
I know that part of the IPCC is to assess all the data that the research carried out by the scientists. So it does look quite bad for some places in the Pacific.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the impacts of climate change, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean we're very aware that, you know, the target of 1.5 degrees is not that far away. The world is already warmed by 0.8, 0.9 degrees, so we don't have very far to go. And so, you know, it is very likely that even if we wanted to get to 1.5 degrees, we would have to so-called overshoot. You know, the temperature would have to go up over 1.5 and then come back down again in order to reach the target. And sea level rise is unfortunately something that we are committed to. Even if we stopped emitting right now, turned it all to zero, the sea level would continue to rise because of the sort of the cumulative effect of all the emissions we've had in the past. So it undoubtedly the case, we need to learn to adapt to climate change as well as taking all the steps to kind of reduce emissions and bring it under control.
Do you notice whether there is quite a strong input by Pacific countries into the IPCC?
Historically, I think the Pacific countries have been perhaps not participating as much as they could be. They're part of one of the IPCC regions, which covers Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia, you know, that part of the world, then plus all the Pacific Islands. And there are only a certain number of places from that region which people can take up. And it's tended to be that you've perhaps seen Australians, New Zealanders, people from Indonesia, you know, taking these places with much lower input from people from the Pacific Islands. I mean, I think it's really good that we've got somebody from Samoa, you know, at this meeting who take a really active part in IPCC in previous cycles, and it's that kind of experience I think you want to build on, you know, in order to build up and get more participation.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The director of the New Zealand Institute for Pacific Research says New Zealand's support for French Polynesia and New Caledonia joining the Pacific Islands forums is a major step. The New Zealand Prime Minister John Key made the announcement during a visit Monday to New Zealand by the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls. He says the new New Zealand foreign minister will now work with 15 other forum members to see there is a pathway forward for the French territories. France and its Pacific territories have been pushing for membership for more than 10 years and in 2006 became associate members. Professor Damien Salcet told Don Wiseman the endorsement from John Key is a major step.
It's a significant development, and it's a sign of what's been developing quite recently is a pattern of a growing closeness between the French Pacific and the English-speaking, if let's call it that, the rest of the Pacific. And, you know, New Caledonia and French Polynesia were in an unusual relationship already within the forum. They were the only two that were associate members. And so in some ways, this is a predictable progression. While St. Fortuna is an observer, and there's a much larger group of observer nations, some of whose status as observers is much more controversial. So it is a big step, a significant step, but it's not an unpredicted step. And I think it also shows that one of the key ways that New Zealand engages with the rest of the world, and particularly in this case with Europe, is through its relationships in the Pacific. And it seemed from what came out in the French Prime Minister's visit yesterday was that one of the primary reasons he came to New Zealand was to talk about exactly these issues with the New Zealand government.
If the French territories did become full members, clearly there'd be increased pressure from the United States for their various territories to also be admitted, because this is something they've been talking about. So the whole nature of the Pacific Islands Forum would change, wouldn't it?
I think there is a great chance that it would signal a kind of larger shift, particularly with the question of Fiji's participation within the forum not resolved. And of course, these two nations have a different kind of profile to many of the core nations of the Pacific Islands Forum. So excluding Australia and New Zealand, the rest of the nations don't tend to have these large European descent populations or foreign populations that we see in New Caledonia, which is by far the largest, but also a substantial one in French Polynesia. So what one might read from that is that on many key questions, they might be closely aligned with others who share their interests, like Australia and New Zealand. Perhaps, I mean, this is all a bit of a prediction.
There had been a distinction made with the setup of the forum in the 1970s, with the setup of the Pacific Community, and that incorporated far more nations. And a part of it was that it was only the independent countries that would be members, but this clearly is something that's going to go by the board.
I think so, and part of it is a searching for the future of the forum. You know, we've got a new kind of leadership coming from the head of Pacific Islands Forum, and what's needed is a clear purpose for all the regional institutions and what's now a very different era where, you know, Australia, China, the US and New Zealand are all equally active in the Pacific. And so this could be seen as a response to the kind of new normal in the Pacific. And it is, as you say, a substantial shift.
Tonga's government is hoping that the upcoming local body elections will usher in a new era of women participating in politics. The Ministry of Internal Affairs has been holding workshops across the islands to promote the idea of women standing in the June elections and also to impact confidence in their ability to be politicians. Chief Executive Mary Bingfawana also invited New Zealand MP Jenny Salasa to take part in one of the meetings. Ms. Bingfawana told Kori Vakura, the government is looking for various ways to improve women's participation, including quotas, and they're exploring options used overseas.
We would definitely look at how Samoa uses temporary special measures and quotas and other examples as well. So we're hoping that with the local elections coming up, I'm scheduled for June, thereafter we would be able to look into assistance on who can help us, give us options to be considered by government and the Legislative Assembly.
What's the history of women in politics in Tonga?
The political reform in 2010 is a huge contributor on how we're progressing forward with having women in politics. Prior to 2010, there hasn't been much involvement of women in politics, but there was a practice parliament that was held, and that had perhaps encouraged and empowered a lot of women and realised their contribution that they can contribute to pushing forward the national policy of gender and development. And women also realising the external impacts of climate change. There are other conventions in terms of the rights of children that women are at the forefront of advocating.
These local body elections, what's it looking like in terms of candidates and women running, taking part?
There would be a fair participation. I cannot say now that there would be a strong participation. There still needs to be a lot of awareness raised in terms of what exactly the role and contribution of women is. There still needs to be awareness in terms of what the actual roles of town and district officers are. At the moment here in Tonga, even with government, at the CEO level, it is approaching 50% of CEOs are women in government ministries. If you go down to the deputy CEOs, it is dominated by women. So it's just translating and transmitting that.
Mrs. Salisa had mentioned that a lot of the obstacles that women faced in Tonga was from their own mindsets and their own mental restrictions that they placed upon themselves. Are you finding that's changing?
I think it's changing. I think the more we hold these workshops and explain to them the roles and their capacity to be able to fulfill the responsibilities, I think it's providing more confidence. Some of them perhaps don't realise that the work that they have contributed to the communities they live in.
Of course, from the male perspective, are mindsets changing there as well?
From research, males vote for women. Most of the voters of women are males. It is the women that don't vote for women. So it is, in my perspective, having women raise awareness and be able to support women as well, because the majority voters for women are men.
Contempt proceedings have been filed in a Papua New Guinea court against the police commissioner, Barry Baki. It is the latest in an increasing convolution chain of legal events around the efforts by police fraud squad to a major fraud case implicating the Prime Minister Peter O'Neill. Johnny Blaze reports.
The police commissioner suspended the director of the fraud squad, Matthew D'Amato, and several colleagues 2 weeks ago. Mr. D'Amato had recently directed the high-profile arrests of the Attorney General, the Prime Minister's lawyer, as well as a Supreme Court judge alleged to have taken a bribe while deliberating on the validity of an arrest warrant for Peter O'Neill. The local court issued a stay order on the suspension, but Gary Barkey subsequently closed the fraud office and locked Mr. D'Amato out. A government MP, Bere Kemisopa, says the commissioner's attempts to block investigations into high-profile fraud cases is a worrying trend. Mr. Kemisopa, who is a former police minister, says the long-standing independence of PNG's police force is under threat.
That's the defining mechanism that ensures that police are effectively doing their job. Now, if you have a police commissioner all of a sudden usurping the authority of the line agencies within the police force, then we will have a difficult time trying to enforce them.
Mr. Kemisopa says that the government must respect the independence of the police.
Now, it's incumbent on everyone in our country, as far as the law is concerned, if there are certain issues or certain implications of impropriety or criminal conduct, it's incumbent on us, especially leaders, more so, to hand ourselves over to the police.
But the Police Commissioner, Robert Atiyafa, has expressed full confidence in the Police Commissioner and the inquiry he has set up into the activities of the fraud squad.
And that's the bottom line. The minute we allow all this to happen, where you have a department like fraud squad being influenced by either then the office of the commissioner, in terms of investigations or in terms of what they're legally bound to do, then that's not on. All those investigations on small cases or high-profile issues need to be done so in consultation with the Office of the Commissioner for Police.
Yet there's a growing chorus of concern that the Police Commissioner is protecting the Prime Minister. The opposition leader, Don Pollyer, says Gary Barkey's actions are destructive to not just the police force and its future, but the whole rule of law and governance in general in PNG.
The inquiry that is undertaken by the Police Commissioner is legally wrong, morally wrong, ethically wrong. There's no credibility in it. There's no integrity. There's no faith in what the Commissioner is doing. The investigation done is only to protect his own position and to protect what we in Papua New Guinea see as corrupt and wrong in nature.
Last year, the previous Police Commissioner, Geoffrey Varkey, was sentenced to 3 years jail for obstructing fraud squad members from enforcing an arrest warrant against the Prime Minister. Shortly before his conviction, the O'Neill-led government appointed Gary Barkey as Police Commissioner, the third change of police chief in 4 years. I'm Johnny Blades.
And finally, a member of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua has written a book about how West Papua is an international issue concerning the purview of international systems. The book, The World's Richest Islands of West Papua Under International System in the 21st Century, was recently published by the Liberation Movement's Pacific Ambassador, Amos Dow. Mr. Dow says there is sound international legal basis for the United Nations to review the so-called Act of Free Choice, the controversial UN-sanctioned referendum by which Papua was formally incorporated into Indonesia in 1969. He told Johnny Blades that West Papuans were never consulted by Indonesia, the Netherlands, and the United States in the 1962 New York Agreement, which paved the way for the transferal of its sovereignty.
The result of this agreement is international resolution of 2504. So it was only 86 states agreed, but other 34 state members, they never agreed because they recognized the process was unlawful. In the process, at that time, in 1962 to 1969, there was no United Nations present to prepare the Act of Free Choice itself. And one case was Indonesia withdraw out from his membership to the United Nations. Automatically, United Nations wasn't there. So this is a great momentum to using by Indonesia to facilitate the Act of Free Choice. So there was no United Nations official or diplomat was there.
And that was supposed to be the case, that the UN were going to be on the ground preparing West Papuans for this process, is that right?
Yes. One of the United diplomats, he has watched it and he reported to the United Nations General Assembly in 1969. He strongly opposed the result of free acts of choice. He said that it only represents by 1,025 people from different tribes in West Papua. And our population was 900,000.
Do you believe that the United Nations still has a role to play in resolving the issues around West Papuan self-determination?
Yeah, I think I'm looking to current developments of our West Papuan diplomacy, specifically in the Pacific regions. I always remember in 2011 during the Pacific Island Forum, the UN King Leader Ban Ki-moon, he said on the media that West Papua case should be discussed at the United Nations Decolonization Committee. So the case already in United Nations So United Nations can act through the act of free choice, because the United Nations is a neutral body.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to contact us to let us know what you think of the program or have any story ideas, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very, very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again, as well as past editions, by visiting our website at any time, www.pcjmedia.com, and just click on the link for Focus Asia Pacific. Also, let us know how you heard the program, either as a download online, FM medium wave, or shortwave. Special thanks goes, of course, to Radio New Zealand. On behalf of everyone here at PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. Thanks so long. Take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah.